Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
With no fees or minimums on checking accounts, it's no wonder the Capital One Bank guy is so passionate about banking with Capital One. If he were here, he wouldn't just tell you about no fees or minimums. He'd also talk about how most Capital One cafes are open 7 days a week to assist with your banking needs. Yep. Even on weekends, it's pretty much all he talks about, in a good way. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Christian Bale was preparing for his role in American Psycho, dressing the part, hitting the gym for the first time in his life, even getting his teeth redone. There was just one problem. He didn't actually have the part. Leonardo DiCaprio did. Listen to our podcast, What Went Wrong, every week as we unearth the chaos behind Hollywood's biggest movie flops and most shocking successes. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for being on Team Human. If you want the ad-free experience of the Team Human team feed, as well as access to our Discord channel, Team Human live salons, and live events, just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. Our next live event is on October 28th in New York City with occult author, scholar, and practitioner Mitch Horowitz, and soundscapes by my friend Stephen Brent. Links on the website and in the show notes. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to embrace paradox, revel in the uncertain, and offer everyone else the opportunity to do the same. You are hereby granted the slack to just be. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, journalist and author of a number of books on technology's impact on humanity, Maggie Jackson.
And we are at the edge of knowledge, and I call it an epic chance. This is your chance. Are you going to back away from that and head back into your assumptions and what you know? Or are you going to go with what people say is the good stress of uncertainty?
Maggie's going to share some of the insights of her new book, Uncertain: The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all uncertain beings. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. Well, hey, I'm just back from a week in Brazil, which was great. Brazilians are great. Brazil is great. Division of wealth, man, not great. Extreme. I was in Sao Paulo, and it's like, you really see the 99.9% just living out in this giant, giant city. It makes New York or Mexico City look small. It may not actually be bigger, but it sure looks bigger. It just goes on and on and on. And then right in the middle, there are these like gated communities of like really wealthy business people wearing Prada sneakers and stuff. It's like there was nobody anywhere close to my income level. One extreme or the other. I went down to Porto Alegre, and they were more. There was a lot more kind of, I don't know, it felt like artists, writers, intellectuals, and kind of middle-class people and professors and other people like me. But boy, but I will tell you, it is a huggy, great place. They still have some connection to their indigeneity, to the ground, to love. They make eye contact and sit and spend actual time together. There's a sense of of spontaneity, and anything can happen. It was nice. It really felt quite alive. I'll tell you, I had a really weird set of airport experiences. I don't know if I should even say it. Oh, I'll say it. What the heck? We're amongst friends. I'm on the, I won't give the airline name. I was on the airplane coming back, and I was just feeling not great. You know, I get all jet laggy and whatever when I'm traveling, and I'm coming home and I want to make sure I'm not going to go home and spread COVID or anything. So, you know, near the end of the plane flight, I took a COVID test out of my bag. And I mean, to be honest, I'm the only one wearing a mask, like on the whole plane. I think there was one person, another person wearing a mask, an older person, but I'm wearing a mask the whole time, just trying to, you know, not be a good citizen, but not get COVID, not bring it home, not get my family sick or anything. And so, but before the plane lands, I figure I'll do a COVID test. If I'm positive, you know, I'll, you know, tell the Uber to take me somewhere else, take me to my office. I'll sleep in there rather than home. So I'm doing the COVID test, and the flight attendant comes over and she's like, I'm going to have to tell the captain about this. I'm like, what? Because, well, you know, if you're coming here, you know, and you suspect you have COVID, I said, I'm just making sure I don't. Then another flight attendant came over and said, you know, I want to go on a vacation. I was going to go on a vacation next week. And if you're giving me COVID, I mean, and these people, none of them are wearing masks, and they're giving me crap for testing, for actually being careful. I was just, it was so bizarre. I mean, I guess in that culture, the idea is you wouldn't even bother to take a COVID test unless you had a strong, strong suspicion that you were COVID positive. So I guess they kind of projected that onto me. If he's doing a test, he must think he has it. But wow, it was so weird. I mean, I won't do it again. I'll do it in the bathroom when I land. But it was weird. I felt so accused as the most negative person on the plane. I mean, the most COVID negative person, the most protected. I was like getting accused of infecting everybody there, or being too wanton with my viral load or something. It was strange. But I'll tell you, when I was waiting, our plane was delayed for a long time, and I was watching in the airport down there all the different people doing their different jobs and, you know, turning on computers and doing their tasks. And I was thinking that these airport workers, they were so young. You know, these are people in their early 20s, you know, and they know their jobs. They clearly know their jobs. But I felt like they didn't have any connection to the larger systems of which they were a part, that they're doing their jobs as if, you know, you get handed the loose leaf notebook that has the tasks that you do. So you open the software and click on this and get that ticket and assign that seat and move on. But they only knew enough to kind of follow the rules of what they were supposed to do to keep the system going. But the whole thing is so understaffed. They are all so overworked that they don't really have time to learn about anything larger than their own task. There's no time to like contemplate, how does this fit into that? There's no one there, at least among the people executing the system, who know enough about it to redesign it, or to think about how could it be made more efficient, or what would this and what would that do if we change this or that. And even if they did, there's so many dependencies and interdependencies and layers upon layers. So if they were looking at the system they're using to assign seats to people, like at the gate, if they could make that better, well, then that would also change the Sabre system, which is used to organize all the seats. Or they'd have to go up to the individual airlines, and then to Expedia and American Express online, and then the price aggregators and the other companies on top of that. All these pieces of a system where the human beings are so stressed and so part of these giant systems that really all we can do is kind of hang on and, you know, try to wait for those off hours and drink something or smoke something and recover to go back into the machine the next day. And even AI is not even, but AI is already like that, where even the best AI programmers, you know, they've had they've got the AI programming the AI at this point. So we can look at the code and see it there, but we don't even know what it quite does. Why did the AI give itself this code? What is it doing for it? It doesn't quite make sense. It's like when the AI plays a game of Go and does some crazy move, and I don't know the logic of that. It just did that. It's the sort of same thing. So now, not only are we parts of systems that we don't fully understand, but we're parts of systems that are made by things we don't understand for reasons and things we don't understand. And the irony of it, to me anyway, is you know, when a person actually gets old or retires or something, you know what they do? They become like a gardener or something, right? They learn a simple craft like making beer from the beginning to the end, or growing food in a garden from the seed to the what's the little germinated thing, the little sprout, and they say, I don't even know, and they put it in, they understand the soil and all. And when they're doing that, they're doing the actual thing from beginning to end in a holistic way, they go, oh, now I get it. Oh, I see, it's alive. That's the way things work. And they think back probably to when they were CEO of that big company 20, 30 years ago. And they said, if only I knew that, that we're in these living systems and that understanding how things work and having time to contemplate them from end to end would give us, gosh, so much more of, I don't even want to say an advantage. It would give us so much more insight into what we're doing and how it fits. We'd be able to create so much more human and life-affirming ways of doing things. I don't know. There's ways back. There's definitely ways back, but it requires pausing and breathing and actually looking at how do these things fit together. And I think that's kind of what we're going to do today.
With no fees or minimums on checking accounts, it's no wonder the Capital One Bank guy is so passionate about banking with Capital One. If he were here, he wouldn't just tell you about no fees or minimums. He'd also talk about how most Capital One cafes are open 7 days a week to assist with your banking needs. Yep, even on weekends, it's pretty much all he talks about, in a good way. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
I'm delighted to bring you today's guest, Maggie Jackson. Maggie and I have been writing about similar topics from different vantage points for many years. I've been looking for an excuse to engage with her about human beings and the effort to find some wiggle room between the ones and zeros of our digital society. And her new book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure, provided the perfect opportunity. We spent an hour in the in-between together, and I'm happy to share it with you. I'm a weirdo in that, you know, when I read Uncertainty, I'm like, oh, that's the way I like to be. I learned to play music like by ear. There was a television in the room and I just sounded out what was on there. A guy, I was at this, my first like real conference of economists when I was just learning digital economics, and some guy gets up and he goes, are you an anarcho-syndicalist? And I had no idea what it meant, right? What the word meant. So I just said, I don't know, can you hum a few bars, right? I wasn't scared. And I don't know when it was that I flipped into being that kind of person, but I'm sure glad I am, especially these days. So I guess first thing I'm wondering from you is, how did you kind of personally realize that being in that weird, squishy, uncertain, in-between place and maintaining it as long as possible was fun and not scary?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Because actually, when I was a kid, my uncertainness And I don't mean, it can be both risk-taking. It can be also just thoughtfulness. As I see it, it was considered kind of shameful. You know, I have a twin sister and she was the one who was immediate, you know, the snap judgment. She could decide anything. And I was treated as this sort of, you know, indecisive person. And I think that I carried that with me. So I guess I've always sort of been on the edge of the known and lived there as a reporter and as a curious person. It's highly related to curiosity. But this book became a kind of act of redemption for me. I also like to take stances or investigate things that are outside of the norm, the mainstream. And this is so much that the bias against uncertainty is so, so sky high, as you know, when you start out saying, I'm a weirdo, you know, because you have a really high tolerance for uncertainty. That's a sort of psychological construct. Then, you know, we know the whole, all of society is based focused on knowing. And where's the rest? It's just something to be gotten rid of, to be pushed past, even in psychological circles.
Yeah. And it's funny because I look at our books and our careers and we've been on parallel tracks in many ways. So I did Present Shock when you were doing Distracted. And it's interesting because there are two different perspectives on the same phenomenon. I'm looking at kind of macro cultural trend of, you know, we're in this presentism and people are aching for conclusion. So I got into, you know, talking about like Apocalypto and I was talking about the Tea Party, saying the Tea Party is going to get really worse if we don't deal with this. It's going to turn into something else and people are going to have conspiracy theory and, you know, the sort of collapse of narrative and when everything happens now. And you were looking at it always from a I don't mean this as a smaller thing, but as on an individual human experiential level, what happens psychologically, emotionally. I mean, a lot of it was grounded in like the science of this, what happens to us. You did, I mean, not to say that I'm not rigorous, but you did rigorous work.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And looking at what is happening to us.
Yeah, but I've always been really fascinated by these macro trends. I mean, the first book that I actually wrote was about the nature of home in the digital age. You know, where do we find refuge when it's permeable? You know, when home is permeable. So I was looking at these macro trends of mobility and what does groundedness mean anymore in this digital age? Long ago. And then the Distracted book was, you know, I mean, the subtitle was the first edition, 2008, The Coming Dark Age. Literally, that was before the financial crisis. People thought it was crazy. I called up the publisher at the last minute and say, don't do it, you know, take down this. And of course, it actually, because I had been dealing with these large macro millennial long ideas about what a dark age is. So
Yeah, I guess macro, I guess, because then I think about this book, though. So then you come forward and I do like Team Human, which is saying human beings live in the squishy place between the one and the zero, the yes and the no. The reason we're not AI is because a human being can maintain paradox over time and experience that as pleasure. But then I read your book and it's like, not only is it cool to have a fetish for that and to have faith in humans, but we're actually more effective. We're more resilient. There's actual data to say. And that to me is like, thank you for being a rigorous scholar. It's funny, for the certainty people, you've brought them evidence that uncertainty is the better place.
Well, I like to think of knowledge, partly because a result of writing this book, as something akin to a tapestry, you know, whose mutability and changingness is part of its strength. Whereas people who are intolerant of uncertainty, retreating into certainty that we see so often today, are treating knowledge as a rock that needs to be defended. You know, it's got its borders, it's got its solidity. And so that those images really say it a lot to me. And I think, yes, and going back to your point about redeeming or putting some science to this, when I first realized, I think I started out writing a book about thinking and skill in thinking, you know, because after Distracted, I was really interested in, well, if you have focus, what do you do with it? Where do you go from there? And what can be contemplative without being religious? And how can we deliberate in a time when we really need to be so hyper-connected at the same time? Where's that balance? It's not going to go away, this hyper-connectivity. So I started out writing a few chapters. The first chapter was about uncertainty. And so I was getting these sort of chimes from people in you know, an editor or a person at a talk, you know, or they're really interested in the uncertainty part. And I realized that's what I was writing about. And it really became, it sort of took over for me rather than, and when I did find that out, I went back to the books and back to the research and looked and saw that there was a sort of a bifurcated, you know, a 0-1 discussion about uncertainty. It was either woo woo, let's embrace it. Gosh, this is so lovely. It's so counterculture.
Right.
Or it was, let's mathematize it out of existence. Let's be, you know, probabilistic. You know, we'll carry on from the Enlightenment and we're going to make a profit out of it. And that's all risk oriented. So really, I felt I peeked under the lid and then I began to see just barely taking off was a new interest in uncertainty. For instance, an organizational journal, scientific old journal would have a headline, you know, introduction to a special issue saying, where have we been with uncertainty? And medicine was waking up to it, although they do it so poorly, and et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of, you know, looked beyond the rock.
Yeah, no, and that's really, that's interesting. First, I just want to pull out for people, writing is a collaborative process. I mean, what you're describing is what is so hard for so many of us to do because we want to write alone and we're scared to share the ideas. But by engaging with others, you ended up evolving the idea toward what mattered. So many people are like running to Substack to write for themselves because it's hard. Editors, they tell you something you don't want to hear sometimes. But it's that, boy, Present Shock wasn't going to be about the moment now. It was an editor that I didn't even go with. It was one of those editors' meetings. And she was like, you know, I think this now business, this presentism is what you're actually writing about. And I didn't know that. It was someone else. Each time, it's someone else. Team Human was my editor, Tom. He said, no, that's not what you're writing. I think you're writing about this. Like, oh, fuck. And it's so important.
I've heard that in the art world too. Someone will be doing, and of course, as you know, when you throw the baby out into the world of what the book is, people see what they want to see in it. Sometimes that can be frustrating, but on the other hand, they see what they carry it with them. They run with it. You learn so much from people's reactions, even post publication. And I just think that, you know, you can be writing, you can be doing a painting as an artist, or you can be writing something, and because or if you don't have your mind made up, which is something I've learned as I've grown older. I still like, you know, having an outline, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm much more loose about where it's going. And I think there's a better product as a result of that. So it's uncertainty every step of the way.
Right, right. And then what I want to do is sort of look at how we got here. I mean, for a lot of this, for me, feels like life in an industrial age or even a digital age. You know, the AI, for example, the way it works is always about finding the most probable thing, you know, the most predictable, probable outcome. And here it is. This is your answer. And humans, especially humans who can embrace uncertainty, we're like about the possible. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I feel like the whole culture has been pushed towards resolving everything to the one or the zero or the answer. Every email you get, what's your answer? And because we got to get through the email, you prematurely resolve whatever the question is to get the thing off your plate. So do you feel like it's sort of this sociocultural thing that's pushed us towards these grounding everything in an answer, in a resolved complete thing? Even Marvel movies, who won, who lost, you know, who's the winner, who's lost, religion, who's damned, who's saved, it always goes to there.
Right. No, I think you're putting your finger on exactly the backdrop to why uncertainty is all the more important now, because we all have fostered a culture that, you know, what's been happening, let me back up a little bit, has been occurring for hundreds of years. You know, with Enlightenment or even the rise of probabilistic thinking, or, you know, Western notions that we could control the earth and we could, you know, find out everything there was to know, and that once we did, there would be nothing left to know. I mean, that's a mantra that we've heard again and again. And I think that the brain was set in stone, our personalities, you know, were set in stone as adults. So you could go on and on and on. What John Dewey, the philosopher, called the quest for certainty has reigned supreme. And now we're beginning to see cracks in this facade of pretense of certainty. And yet, at the same time, we've developed this architecture, you're so right, you know, where business meetings have to be outcome-oriented. And someone just told me the other day about a term called finishers. Are you a finisher? And that means you just, you know, take something from the meeting and you get it done instantly. And the pressures go on and on. And of course, technology, you know, we could talk about not just the aesthetics of the neat, pat, template, box-oriented view or format of the information that we're imbibing, but also the pace and the way it's doesn't broker, you know, that Google actually answers the question that we're asking. They're offering an answer before we even finish the question. I mean, you know, you use the word premature. It's really true. And I think we've sort of adopted these habits, as you and I have talked about. The machine changes us just as we change the machine or whatever device we're using. And so therefore, we really do. We're really mired in the quest for certainty, the daily life of, you know, just trying to resolve everything, so much so that the cultural bias against being uncertain is deeply, deeply rooted in our culture. You know, there's one study at Columbia University that did, through video studies, showed people videos of leaders, political leaders, business leaders, and I'm forgetting the third category, but people who were shown or contemplating a new complex problem, And then when they paused to deliberate for 30 seconds, they were labeled by the participants observing them as not influential, as less competent as a business leader. This is not a surprise. And the study was actually portrayed in the journal as being, oh, this is a problem. Don't deliberate. I mean, one of the chapters I thought was really interesting, or one of the pieces of research that I did, which was really interesting, was all about forgetting. It was just about, it's about downtime. Doing nothing in the mind is anathema. And really, the more I plumbed into memory, I mean, we know memory is fickle, and yet we complain about that, and witnesses can't be trusted, and you know, we've got to Google it because our memories are so poor, et cetera, et cetera. But the more I plumbed into particularly what resting, pausing, sleeping, these sorts of fallow time, I call it, does, the more I realized how much I, not just that downtime is fantastically good for building memory, you know, for that kind of capture of knowledge that we love so much, but it's also extremely amazingly good for gaining hidden insight, abstracting knowledge. So in other words, what does this imply? This implies, and then one example I'll give is the hippocampus, the sort of first basket of experience that helps us turn experience into memory, actually registers time, place, sequence, all sorts of little notations about a memory or a fact or an experience. And therefore, it's actually helping the mind to fold information into larger knowledge networks. And this is not a matter, of uploading and downloading and the sort of metaphors that we use about the machine. What this does is it's a matter of time and a sort of natural, I hate to use the word organic, but the idea that knowledge is living, knowledge is not a bedrock, knowledge is not a file folder, really came home to me in this chapter. And then when we struggle, the most amazing thing is when we struggle back into that memory, when we put it aside and it begins to fade and kind of corrode, actually that's even better for our minds, because in struggling through these knowledge networks, this architecture of the mind, you're actually strengthening associations related to that memory. So we're so focused on an outcome, on a narrow outcome, on what we think we need to know, that we miss the great contextual nature of knowledge. We miss the impact of time on the consolation of time, the suspense that is uncertainty. I really thought that was, it's single-handedly, you know, this idea of memory as not being a loss and forgetting as a friend to learning, is what scientists say, is really a total counterpoint to how we see our minds as deficient machines.
I know. There's so many trailheads in there. I mean, the first is when you're talking about sort of the free time to do nothing and to be there. Sometimes we call it being bored, but actually embracing that space. It's funny, the words we even have for it. It's like, oh, you're lollygagging, right? You're being lazy. And it's like, no. I mean, the first thing the Israelites gave themselves after leaving Egypt was the Sabbath, right? Was a day.
Exactly.
And it's not that you're resting from the work. It's that, no, you have a sacred space. This is you now. Be there. The second thing I started to think about was people often ask me about writer's block. Oh, do you have writer's block? You know, time you can't write. It's like, I wouldn't call it writer's block. I have germination time. That if I'm not writing, I'm still doing something. I'm sitting there. It's germinating under the surface. And that's because the last thing you were saying was this different understanding of knowledge, that because of computers partly, and maybe even books and print, we think of knowledge almost as these nouns, these things, these inanimate, like knowledge is that butterfly that I killed and stuck a pin in and put it on the board. But you're saying knowledge is a verb. You know, it's a moving, living thing that has all these associations. And when you think of knowledge more as sort of living RAM rather than hard drive storage, it opens up into this sort of living network of ideas that's constantly bouncing off each other.
Right. And that no, precisely. Sounds like you're very far ahead of, you know, me in dealing with uncertainty. I think you got it down. I'm still struggling. And what's really interesting, too, is that, you know, another way in which I think this upending our notions of uncertainty upends our knowledge of what knowing is, but it also, and what time and what space is, but it's also really, you know, it kind of changes our ideals of can change, and I think change should our ideals of success. And what are we here for? And turns all those ideas about efficiency. I mean, that's another word I hadn't mentioned when, you know, in the run up to this incredible, colossal bias against uncertainty, we've had this whole onus on efficiency. You know, if it's not efficient, or if someone asked me one more time, did you have a productive day? I think I might just do something violent, because I just feel as though, why do we have to achieve 42 widgets, $42, 42 followers?
I was trying to describe, before I knew to use the word uncertainty, I was trying to describe this place that humans can go, and trying to make people, like, I called it the space of suppose, like when you're supposing something, just suppose with me for a minute, because everybody's listening. And I wanted to open people up, especially when I'm speaking to an audience. And I'm like, can you just suppose? And I would like show you, can you just open your mind, just open your head a little bit and suppose this with me? And it may feel uncomfortable, but it's actually cool. And I said, imagine, and this was the only way I could say it, was like, you know, when you make a weird sound and your dog's looking at you and it kind of tilts its head a little bit diagonally to the side, when it's like, huh? I like, that's the place you want to live, is where the dog's going, huh? You know, and
right.
And it felt like your book was sort of an answer to that, that this is not a bad thing, that this is an intensely pleasurable place of, huh?
Exactly. No, I think that's really right. And you know what? It can be intensely pleasurable and also uncomfortable. You know, I think that basically we are often very allergic to discomfort. So one of the sort of processes of, and I'll get a little bit more to the, you know, to the idea of the suppose, which I think is so perfectly important and central to what I'm trying to do here. But just to go with the discomfort a little bit, you know, in sort of the neuroscience of when you meet something new and unknown and ambiguous, there is quite an incredible reaction in your mind called arousal. And that is basically, you know, it is not fight or flight. It is your brain's response to meeting something that they don't know about, that it doesn't know about, that you don't know about. And the cascading implications are astonishing, all because of stress hormones and chemicals that, you know, create more receptivity to new information on the part of both the neurons and also different parts of the brain. It creates more cross dialogue between brain regions. Your working memory expands, your focus expands, you know, sometimes call it curious eyes. And so this is uncomfortable. Because what the mind is doing, as one neuroscientist told me, is saying to itself, something's to be learned here. And we are at the edge of knowledge, and I call it
an epic chance. This is your chance. Are you going to back away from that and head back into your assumptions and what you know? Or are you going to go with what people say is the good stress of uncertainty? So it's really, I mean, it's just like, I don't know, bungee jumping or, you know, doing something new that you actually nail, you know, whitewater rafting or however it is. You are on your toes. I call it also wakefulness. You're waking up. And when you are most stressed, that's when things are most unpredictable, you should be most stressed. You should be in tune with that. So there's just a good tremendous amount of implications about that. And so I think that the suppose is sort of a tiptoeing into that, because I think I would sort of guesstimate that that's basically the preface to leaping or nudging or tiptoeing into that edge of the unknown. And there's another really interesting facet of this, which is in children's learning. And why wouldn't we want to learn more about children's learning so we can be more childlike? They do it so well. There's something called the zone of proximal development. Well, that's often talked about now in developmental circles and schools and education as a parent or a caregiver or a teacher scaffolding the child. So they are there to help when the child might be overwhelmed. But on the other hand, they know to step back when the kid is just kind of stretching themselves and learning. But that's not just what it's about. This zone of proximal development, which was a term created by a Russian psychologist called Vygotsky, is actually about all of human growth and learning. We want to be at the edge. If we're not pushing toward the edge of what we know, well, then we're just staying within the rubric of both our comfort zone and also what we already know. And it is astonishing how much of the business world or the organizational world or our daily world is just plonked down, settled in comfort on the couch of what we already know. And so, yes, you're constantly being able to kind of confront things that you don't know, but do we retreat or do we lean into that? And of course, that's also the zone of uncertainty. So there really is this wonderful, and the metaphors, Doug, the metaphors are amazing. There's an Australian philosopher who studied metaphors related to uncertainty, and they are both lostness, darkness, then also exploration and wandering. And it's really an interesting little, you know, mushment, you know, a great little soup of both things that you can say are positive and things that you can say are maybe not, are uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, for some people, it's more than psychological discomfort. I mean, part of what, I mean, I worry about this with everything I write and read, but do you think that this sort of tolerance for uncertainty is partly a matter of privilege? If you don't know where your next meal is coming from, or that it's coming at all, it's hard to embrace uncertainty, right? Uncertainty is life or death kind of uncertainty. I mean, this sort of over-certainty or fetish for certainty in some ways is kind of a privileged white people's problem, no?
Yes, no, that is such a great question, and I'm so glad you're asking about that. Because, you know, if you carry that idea of arousal and vigilance into precarious situations, for instance, people who have been raised in precarity are often hypervigilant. They're edgy. You can see this on a city street or in a, you know, neighborhood where people have had social injustice and challenges and financial. They are on guard. And same with adopted children, same with kids who grew up in alcoholic families. You know, in precarious situations, you have that kind of arousal times 10. And that is actually perfectly smart, it can actually be called street smarts, an evolution, adaptation to a particular situation. However, you know, when kids get to school, they are in a situation where the predominant value system is related to skills that emerge from a world that assumes life is predictable. So a society fearful of unpredictability will not like an edgy, quick, street smart kid in the classroom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, currently there's a raft of a movement really to uncover the hidden strengths of kids who are raised in precarity and then kind of rehumanize these, you know, people who are often denigrated for, you know, the skills that the privileged society deems
unusable, expendable, or something that that should be reformed. And I think this is really important. So tolerance of uncertainty is a very wide, huge spectrum. It's both a state and a trait. It's both situational, and it's also a trait. We're all born with, or we all at least have a particular kind of spectrum of when we're, you know, I can be a bungee jumper, but I can be intellectual, fearful of, you know, situations where I don't know the answer. Then we also are situational. So when we're feeling pressure, when we're feeling time, when life is really unpredictable, our tendency is to close down on an answer. And I think that it's very messy, these issues. It's very difficult. But I think what's most important is to question what's always been in terms of our assumptions about, you know, uncertainty. It's yet another piece of evidence that shows that uncertainty is not the fearful, it's not the problem we think it to be. It's our attitudes toward uncertainty that are often the problem.
Right. And in that sense, it's like some amount of safety, a sense of safety is a prerequisite to moving into uncertainty. You know, there's teachers, I know some music teachers, like, who will almost, like, well, not even almost, abuse, they will abuse the student to put them in a state of, you know, they think it's valuable to have the person feeling unsafe so they discover new things. And I found the opposite, that once they feel genuinely safe, then they can move into uncertainty intentionally and with purpose and for fun. You know, so, and also in terms of privilege, it's like you've got to at least have your feet on the ground and know that someone's not going to hit you in the back of the head and that there's going to be food. Then you can sort of move into intentionally uncertain spaces of discovery.
Right. And I think that it's also another way to look at it is to think that what skills do we need when the world is more unpredictable? And there is evidence that, you know, the climate is more volatile, that work hours are more precarious, that, you know, that the world may be growing more unpredictable. And what skills do we need? Well, we need the deep focus. We need that sense of safety that allows us to go deeply, that in times when we can give in to that fallow time, when we need to understand, you know, stop and pause, even in the middle of a crisis in an operating room, if you're a surgeon, and examine the multiple possibilities. That's the spaciousness of uncertainty, you know, quoting Rebecca Solnit. But at the same time, we need to be so-called on point. We need to understand what's going on around us. We need to be vigilant about change. And so I think we need a lot of different arrows in our quiver. And that's right. Really important.
I know, but these are almost impossible states to achieve if you're like living on the platform formerly known as Twitter, right? If you're living in an always on punctilist environment, I mean, you could visit those spaces, I guess, but do you know what I mean? It's anathema to this state of psychic leisure, you know, that allows for the uncertainty to arise.
Right, exactly. And being vigilant and attuned to the world and observant and street smart is not the same thing as necessarily as you know, snap judgment and exactly, belligerence and, you know, hostility and stereotyping and, you know, assumptions. Stereotypes are immediate judgments that we unconsciously make about another. They're not allowing the spaciousness of uncertainty so that you can see the potential in another, not the set in stone wrong that you assume. I think that uncertainty as in its many, many, many forms and guises, everything from deliberation to reverie to tolerance from another to taking the perspective taking, you know, the kind of Socratic not knowing that you don't know or allowing a moment to think that perhaps I don't know. Those are all really important. I call it modes of uncertainty in action. And we can see opportunities for this everywhere in our daily life. And I can also see technology with the help of technology, but also socially in other ways, retreat into certainty as the easy way out, as the way, you know, that's, I think, the, some of the root of polarization. I mean, these are all really complex issues, and some of the root of our unresolved relationship with the machine and delegating our own thinking to our devices and technology. Again, it comes from this unwillingness to understand. We need a language of uncertainty, and we need to understand how it can be used as a skill. And just going back again to the where I kind of fell into this wonderful world of uncertainty, you know, at first, I must say, I really balked at changing my book and writing about uncertainty, not just because I felt like, well, it was, you know, really, the great thinkers all say it's about risk, so that's what it must be, and maybe there's nothing else, and et cetera. But I also felt as though it was really squishy. And I, you know, I felt as though it was so completely not, you know, I didn't really see, even though I, you know, every bone in my body is, you know, kind of against over-certitude, it was very hard to get traction and to understand. And the main thing that was really difficult was to see uncertainty as active. You know, people would always say, oh, yeah, you have to be uncertain. And then you go on to think, you have to be uncertain to do. And I kept thinking, no, it's an accompaniment. It's our escort. It's our strength. It's our fuel. And it took a really long time. But I have really discovered quite a bit of scientific evidence that shows that is true.
Right, right. And it's interesting, you know, as I went through the sort of the journey of uncertain, a lot of things that I thought of as false certainty revealed themselves as delightful, intentional uncertainty. I mean, I was thinking a lot about people of faith as I was reading it, and sort of, you know, Christians in particular, because it's just sort of the stereotypical people of faith, but like people who have faith and faith in God, and they talk about their faith. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, the act of faith, an act of faith, it's active. You don't do faith and stop. If people are going to have faith in God or Christ or Buddha or whatever, if you're going to have faith, then you are in some ways leaping through uncertainty. Do you know what I mean? It's like such an active thing. It's not a passive giving up.
Exactly. It's something you wrestle with every step of the way. Exactly. It's not a light switch that you turn on and off, nor is knowledge, nor is certainty. And of course, it's very difficult to, you know, say, well, there is no certainty, or, you know, no certainty but taxes and death. No certainty. But of course, there is sureness. There's even certainty, you know, as long as it's not indefinite uncertainty. You know, you can be certain that you, I'm getting a lot of jokes already, you know, I'm certain I'm going to buy your book. Okay, that's okay. You know, but the jokes. But I.
That's all right. I'm not.
And yeah, I mean, the I don't know is, we're allergic to the I don't know, but we're also, I don't know if we really tapped the potential of the word certain. You know, we need, again, we need these nuanced languages. But, you know, it's really important to get beyond the fear that is attached to this word. And it's treated as a shameful flaw to be uncertain. And that's really, really important. I think it's really important to strip away all of the negative that we have, even with that word, and then move on to exploring this extraordinary frontier. And, you know, why can't we talk about knowing a little bit, or partial knowing, or what John Keats, the poet, called half knowledge? And, you know, he railed against all his friends like Coleridge, who were trying to constantly make up their minds before they really knew what they were talking about.
Right. I mean, in some ways, I don't blame people for being intolerant or incapable of embracing uncertainty. You know, when I look at the world that they're living in, you know, the Twitter, Fox News, crazy that's all around us, I understand why people are looking. I mean, the whole left talks about their fact-based, you know, we're in fact-based reality and all that. They're just like, wait a minute, this is a house of mirrors. What's going on? So I do think, like, the way we're going to bring ourselves to places of uncertainty, the prerequisite's going to be helping people get their feet on the ground, knowing something, knowing they're safe, knowing that they're, that there's others here, you know, that there's, you know what I mean? You have to, there are, I guess, let me ask this as kind of a final question. What are the best ways to kind of set the table for uncertainty?
Sure. No, and it's, I think that's a really important question. And you're right. No, it's, we need places of structure. We need sort of the foundational sureness. We need routines and habits, you know, that we can be sure of. I mean, these were lifelines in the pandemic. But I think that, you know, how do we start this? I think, you know, we can perhaps take a page from the many, many interventions that are now being created. And this is brand new and they're very successful. Some are in pilot study or et cetera. You know, this is clinical, but I think we can all kind of run with this. And many, many of these interventions to boost people, to allow them to lean into uncertainty. And, you know, the word tolerance is kind of mushy and vanilla and all that sort of thing. But really, it's practicing being unsure and changing your mind about it. You know, many of them are being used for anxious people, which is sort of a global epidemic. I mean, it's the single most prevalent disorder among children in the United States. And a lot of it, you know, is borrowed from exposure therapy, but it has, you know, twists and turns. It's not just exposing you to uncertainty and that's that, like exposing to a spider or something. You know, what it is practicing courting uncertainty. And sometimes that's doing something new, trying a new dish at a restaurant seems small, seems totally, you know, granular, et cetera. But at the same time, it's pushing the boundaries of what's where you can be uncomfortable and yet also move through it. And I mentioned curiosity a minute ago. You know, one of the biggest, most important facets of being a curious person is something that's called stress tolerance. And that is actually being able to handle the stress of exploring the unknown. So basically, people who are stress tolerant, and this stress tolerance is actually highly related to well-being. Well, why is that? Why are people who are open to and even, you know, leaning into the distress of the unknown actually are happier people? It's because when you're open to all of life, the good and the bad, the disquieting and the soothing, well, then you're really thriving. Then you're really living. Then you're seeing life as it is, not how you wish it to be. So I guess I would just say, you know, we can all start small and then just rethink our very, very highly negative attitudes toward. You can let someone daydream, or you can let someone pause and think. You can let someone sit and do nothing at the office, which is usually, you know, a tantamount to saying you're a loser. You know, we can allow each other, and, you know, team human can come together on this and basically not just think afresh about how we use the devices, but also, you know, back off them in order to recapture the not knowing human. Not knowing
right.
human.
And the interesting thing about it that I like is, like, in some ways your answer to how do we allow for more uncertainty is like, well, you can allow for more uncertainty in yourself, but actually it's a little bit easier to give other people slack to be uncertain. In other words, let's engender, promote, and encourage uncertainty in those around you, and then maybe hope that they'll do the same for you.
Exactly. No, I think that's just true. That's really important. Give each other that spaciousness of uncertainty, and, you know, we'll all be better off from it. We all might be able to change our minds without being called a, you know, horrible flip-flopper. We all might be able to see potential in someone whose politics we hate. We might be able to see that we might be able to stand up for what's right while adjusting what right is.
Mm-hmm. Which is very human. So thank you. Thanks for that. Thanks for granting us all the slack to move into uncertain places. It's as team human as it gets. And it's, boy, I think it's going to be essential if we want to sustain this thing, this project moving forward. So thank you, Maggie. Thanks so much for your work and for being on Team Human.
Thank you, Doug. It was a fantastic conversation. And I appreciate your understanding of uncertainty.
It's uncertain. I'm uncertain about it still, luckily.
I don't know.
And thank you for being on Team Human. You can learn more about Maggie Jackson and her new book, Uncertain, by going to maggie-jackson.com. Or go to teamhuman.fm, where you can find out more about Maggie, get links to her stuff, and all of our guests. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
With no fees or minimums on checking accounts, it's no wonder the Capital One Bank guy is so passionate about banking with Capital One. If he were here, he wouldn't just tell you about no fees or minimums. He'd also talk about how most Capital One cafes are open 7 days a week to assist with your banking needs. Yep, even on weekends, it's pretty much all he talks about. In a good way. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.